Dear Ajahn, I was very thoughtless. Yes! No thoughts. That's excellent. Well done. With a monk earlier today. Is that a good attitude? P.S. Oh, yeah. I hear reincarnation is making a comeback. If you don't believe in reincarnation in this life, you will in your next. Very thoughtless with a monk earlier today. Is that a good attitude? If you mean careless, okay. But thoughtless, yes. Feel it, don't think it. You know, sometimes you think about things, things get so complicated. But if you feel, you feel what's appropriate, what's not appropriate. Just like sometimes if people give me any moral dilemmas, what should you do? I stop thinking about it and feel it. Just, you know, what feels right. And I find that it's a much more appropriate means of discovering just, you know, what to do and what's correct and what's the best option. So you feel the truth, first of all. And from that feeling, then you can start thinking about, oh, yeah, that's true. Because, you know, there's something that before you even think, you know that this is not appropriate to do or this is the appropriate thing to do. You can feel it first of all, and then afterwards, you're like, oh yeah, that's right. So you get out of your head into your heart more. Please say this so it can be printed on bags too. Ha 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 ha. The more you carry, the more you need. So true. If you ever go and see our storeroom over in Bodhinyana Monastery, I designed that, I built that, and the other monk said, this is going to be too small. And I said, yes, I know it's going to be too small. However you big you build it, it will always eventually become too small. But so keeping it tiny to begin with means that whenever people give us any more requisites, we have to give them away. We just can't fit them in. And that's a wonderful thing to have. So any excess robes, any excess bowls, we get sort of sometimes too many of them, and so we have to give them away. Isn't that wonderful? We got enough for the few monks there, but we don't need to store very much. Because you find, however big your storeroom or pantry is, it's never big enough. However big your wardrobes are at home, it's always, you can't fit everything else in. However big the shelf is, it always gets packed with things. Which brings me to the old story of my mother's mantel shelf. This is a shelf which was above the fire, which was an electric fire. And that was, you know, in the old days, you'd used to have a coal fires or wood fires and a shelf above where you put the clock, photos of somebody's marriage or something. You know, just a nice little shelf there. And on that shelf, the first time I went to visit my mother, someone said, oh, why don't you, no, when I was in Australia, why didn't you take something like Australian to give to her? And like a bottle of beer was not the right thing to take to my mother. So instead, a little stuffed kangaroo. What a wonderful thing to give to your mum. So I took a little kangaroo and I gave it to my mother. She loved it so much, she put it on the shelf and the mantelpiece, thinking, oh, when my son goes back to Australia, I can always look at that. And I remind me, that's my son gave me that over in Australia. That's a very nice thing to do. But then next time I went to visit, you know, she already had a kangaroo, so I got her, I think it's a kookaburra. No, wombat. Wombat was number two. No, not wombat. What's that? Koala bear. Koala bear, yes. So I got her a koala bear, and she thought, oh, that's very Australian, very cuddly. And so she put that back next to the kangaroo. And the next time it was a kookaburra, and then a platypus, and then a wombat. I think when I got to the wombat, there was no more space on the shelf. And so she spent an hour trying to balance everything on that shelf. And things kept falling off. And I told her, why don't you, you've had that kangaroo for such a long time. Give it to charity. Give it away. You know what she said? No. I love that little kangaroo and the koala. I'm so attached to it. So she spent another hour trying to balance everything on the shelf. And when things fall off, I thought, that's like having a nervous breakdown. Mm-hmm. Carrying too much in your bag. And that's why people get stressed out and go crazy. They carry too much. So what do? I told my mother, look, kangaroo, throw it away. The koala, throw it away. The new one I just bought today, the wombat. Put that in there, throw everything else out, get rid of it. And that means that the new one has focus. There's too many animals in it. You can't even see them. There's too many of them. And I thought, that's the thing with our life. However big your shelf, it will never be big enough. And because we keep accumulating more and more, we can't let go of things. We can't just throw them away. That's why it comes a time we've got too many things in our head and we just go berserk. So the more you carry, the more you need. And the more you need, the more your bag gets stuffed. And eventually you just put so much in there, it sort of splits. It's puzzling what fellow retreatants carry in their big bags. Investigating. Ha ha ha. Maybe we should have an x-ray machine when you come here. And I can x-ray all your bags and see how many packets of noodles and biscuits and stuff. Just in case. So it's wonderful when you come here anyway, you have comfortable clothes. You don't need to have fashionable clothes. Isn't it wonderful, especially a girl, you don't have to wear fashionable clothes. Just what's nice and comfortable and nice and loose. You don't have to worry about your hair. You just shave it off while you're here. I always think that's a wonderful thing to do. And then you can get wigs. Because wigs, you know, you don't need to sort of worry about them. You can have a blonde wig, a redhead wig, an afro wig, or whatever you need to wear. And just like, you know, what dress shall I wear to work today? I said, oh, maybe I'll have the blonde wig today. So you can actually choose what you want to look like today. Wouldn't it be fun? It's much cheaper than going to a hairdresser's, you know. Because the wig, you know, if you want to wash it, you just put it in the washing machine. Instead of sitting for hours in the hairdresser's. That's true, isn't it? Show you how much I know about stuff. Anyway. If objects of consciousness include Vedana, isn't dependent origination tautological since Nama Rupa leads to Vedana and Nama Rupa is part of Vedana? It's not tautological. It's that these things, you can take an aspect of it, the fact that the Vedana is one of the objects of consciousness, but it's also that consciousness creates the Vedana as well. So, if you add this time business in it, causality, it's not just all in the same moment, but some do create something afterwards. And a good example of that people tended to say, oh, you have delusion creates the sankhara creates consciousness all in the one moment. Abhidhamma says that, but it makes no sense. Because if delusion created sankharas and sankharas created consciousness all in the same moment, what about dependent cessation? When delusion is overcome, you're an arahat. No delusion anymore. So that means no sankharas, no consciousness, no sense basis, no experience. So it means all arahats, as soon as they become an arahat, that means they must be unconscious. And you know that's not the case. The Buddha, after he became enlightened, he taught for 45 years. He wasn't unconscious. So it shows that means consciousness in your next life. Creates a consciousness in the future. Or somebody said, we depend on origination. I think it was this scallywag Ajahn Brahm. You look at, you know, in brief, what is dependent origination and dependent cessation. You've got these two parts, or two factors, the will and the craving. Will is like the sankharas, the volitions. You know, the kaya sankhara, vachi sankhara, and the chitta sankhara, the volitions of body, speech, and mind. And he said, that is what drives for the creation of consciousness in the next life. Just the same way that craving is the fuel which creates the new states of existence. So it's like the craving and the will coming together. They push you into creating new states of existence. I often say that they say the Industrial Revolution started in UK, in London. Why? That was exactly the same time when they started importing coffee from, I think, Brazil. And I can think, understand why they had the Industrial Revolution. They were all very happy and peaceful. But then, they were drinking too much coffee in the coffee shops and had all these great ideas of how we can invent this and how we can invent that. That was a mind restless through just to drinking too much coffee. That's my theory, anyway. So, that's the technological revolution. So, has it really helped? Or has it driven more people crazy? Whenever I go to Thailand, I usually stay in this place where Ajahn Chah used to stay, and even Ajahn, Luapriyan stays there as well. Nice, quiet little place. And I was talking with the family there some years ago, and they said before they actually moved down there, they were living in the district Sathorn, which is where all the embassies are in Bangkok. And one day they decided to move out to where it was a bit more clean and calm and green and quiet. So they got an ox cart to pull them, and it took about 3 or 4 hours to get to this place, which they brought. And they said these days, to get from Sathorn to where they lived in the bottom of Sukhumvit Road, it still takes 3 or 4 hours. It's in a car, but that's because of traffic jams. So it hasn't improved at all. Still takes the same time to get from one place to another. So anyway, so if objects of consciousness include Vedana, yes they do, it's part of Nama Rupa, but it's not tautological because the objects of consciousness now, they support consciousness. Consciousness supports the objects of consciousness. You can't have one or the other. So it is codependent. One, if you have one, you have to have the other. So we say it doesn't cause. It's actually part of it. As soon as you have consciousness, you have objects of consciousness. You have sense bases. You have all aspects of that. Just like Ajahn Brahm. You can't have Ajahn Brahm without bad jokes. You know, it's not that Ajahn Brahm causes bad jokes, it's just part of the deal. Like Vedana is part of the deal when you have sense bases and when you have Nama Rupa and consciousness. What are your tips for beginner, semi-beginner meditators? You are so lucky being a beginner. Because many people, they get the best meditation when they don't know what they're doing. And monks like me come along and tell you all what to do, then you start to expect. And then you see another teacher say you should do this, and someone else says to teach that. And you get all sorts of confused. But when you're beginning, it can be so easy. Has anyone ever taught you how to breathe? You just do it. So to tell you what I mean, many years ago, that meditation started to become well known in the West. And so I must have been about 5 or 6 years as a monk in Thailand. So how long ago? About 38 years ago. There was a professor who came all the way to the northeast of Thailand from Sweden to ask Ajahn Chah a number of important questions. He was paid by the government of Sweden to go to many, many, many different meditation teachers in India, in Burma, in Sri Lanka, and I was in Thailand, to ask them the same four questions on meditation. Because if you're a professor, you have to systemize everything. So the same four questions, like a survey, get the answers from all these different, you know, famous meditation masters, so you can collate the report. And that's academia. So the same four questions he asked. And so when he came to Ajahn Chah's heart, and I was there, and sort of heard he was from the government of Sweden, official business. So Ajahn Chah took him seriously. Had to have a translator. And said, "What do you want?" And it was, "I've been commissioned from the government of Sweden, I'm a professor of some university, to do an inquiry about what meditation is. So I've got these four questions. Would you be kind enough to answer them?" And I said, "Yeah, of course. What are the four questions?" And the four questions were, what is meditation? Why do you meditate? How do you meditate? And what do you get out of meditation? He said, "I've asked so many gurus and spiritual leaders and holy men, and this is the questions I've now asked you." And then I just said, "Whoa, important questions." So he asked for a piece of paper and a pencil. That was a sign that my master was up to something. When he did something like that, you know that this is going to be fun. Totally unpredictable, because he never does that. And then he took the pencil and he took the paper and he scratched his head, which he never does either. He's just playing around. It's great fun being around a master like that, because it was fun, unpredictable, but in the end it was always really deep. So, he wrote down his answers, 1, 2, 3, 4. And then he gave them to the translator, who laughed, of course, you know, because he could read them first. And then, you know, he told the professor, "My master Ajahn Chah, his answers to your questions, and please take it back to the government of Sweden. The answer to your first question, what is meditation? Ajahn Chah answers, what is eating? The second question is, why do you meditate? My master's answer is, why do you eat? The third question, how do you meditate? His answer is, you've guessed it, how do you eat? And the answer to the fourth question, what do you get out of meditation? His answer is, what do you get out of eating? And you know, it's amazing. But that professor was really angry and upset. "I can't take that back to my government. That's a stupid answer." He said, "That's all you're getting." And he refused to give any more answers. And you know, that was just a powerful answer. You know, just, what is meditation? What's eating? Has anyone ever told you what eating is? Just, why do you eat? You're hungry. That's why Ajahn Chah used to call it food for the heart, meditation. Yeah, you've got to eat good food, otherwise you get sick. If you don't eat peace, kindness, relaxation, your mind gets very sick. People eat junk food for their mind. Junk food for the mind is watching TV, fantasizing, thinking, talking too much, because you have to hear what people say. That's actually junk food for the mind. Worries, hanging on to the past, guilt, all those sorts of stuff. That's junk food. That really makes you sick. So why do you meditate? Why do you eat? For good health and happiness. Spiritual, mental health. You know, this mental health is one of the biggest problems all over the world. It's getting worse. More and more people have just, governments, they just can't keep up with the demand for people who have mental health issues. Why? Because people eat junk food in their mind. anxiety, guilt, and what's the other thing is anger. It's all junk food. And fantasies, worries, anxieties, junk food. Thinking too much, junk food. Just rest, relax. Go out and watch the stars tonight. The full moon's out. The real full moon is tomorrow, but you go out there, the full moon is gorgeous. That's not junk food, that's health food. So, that's why we eat. How do you eat? Do I have to tell Singaporeans how to eat? It's natural, isn't it? And how do you meditate? It's the most natural thing in the world to do. You shouldn't really need to be taught how to meditate. Just let go. Sit there, do nothing. What's easier than just sitting there doing nothing? Making peace with this moment. That should be simple, shouldn't it? You look at kids playing around, they don't carry the past. Unfortunately, we were taught how to think and how to worry and encouraged to do so. And sort of strange that now you have to unlearn all that stuff. I think if you don't plan your future, it will all go wrong. I planned my future, it went wrong anyway. Or like intelligence, praising intelligence. But what was that poem? I put that poem in the first book, Opening the Door of Your Heart by Tsung Po. On the birth of my first son. Should be a celebration, shouldn't it? This was a very famous, very smart thing, you know, Mandarin in the Court, a great poet, Tsung Po. And he said, families, when a son is born, want it to be smart and intelligent. Do you want your kids to be intelligent, do well at school? But, he said, myself, I, through intelligence, have ruined my own life. Now I wish my child to be born stupid. Then he will live a very tranquil life. And at the end, crowning his career of stupidity by becoming a cabinet minister. Or something like that. That's actually really quite smart. You know, all the politicians, Prime Minister, President, Mr. Trump, is he really smart? But if you're really intelligent, oh my goodness me, no tranquility at all. Always having to defend, talk, present. So there's something too. Actually, not really stupidity or intelligence, but that middle way. Not too smart, not too dumb. Not too successful, not too unsuccessful. Not too rich, not too poor. Study after study after study done throughout the whole world. I remember first reading this, published by the London School of Economics. Just looking at people's income levels and their happiness. Obviously, if you're too poor, if you struggle to get by, you haven't got enough to feed your family and to pay your bills and just a little bit more, you know, you suffer. But if you have too much money, it's just too much responsibility and you just get stressed out worrying about the stock market and investments and, oh, you have no peace at all. So they found out there is actually an optimum income level. If you eat less than that, you know, it's not really happy. More than that, it's not very happy. And I think it worked out, not that much, about individual, about something like £50,000 a year or something. That's quite a few years ago, but if you earn more than 50,000, I think, was it 50,000 or, sorry?
Dollars.
Okay, $50,000 a year. If you earn more than that, you know, your happiness level actually declined. Too many worries, too many things to concern yourself. Why can I sort of get rid of this or invest that and all those other responsibilities when you have excess money which you have to invest and look after. But too little level, under $50,000, it was also very difficult. Feeding, worrying how you can get by. So even that, there's a middle way, income. So I often say this because if anyone here is earning way above $50,000 a year, $200,000, I can make you happier. We have little donation slips for Anukampa Bhikkhuni Monastery over there. So you can make lots of merit by helping out a poor nun, and at the same time you're happier. It's a win-win situation. So, you know, you don't ask people to give donations to make them unhappy. You know, we just give donations to make you even more happy. What a wonderful opportunity that is for you. I don't know why, it never works. But anyway, back to being a beginner in meditation. The tip is, you're so wonderful, keep it simple, like Ajahn Chah would do. You know, what you get out of meditation should be good health, peace. If you're not getting peace, you're not relaxing, you know, it's not the right meditation. It's not meditation. Something's wrong there somewhere. And of course, what's wrong? Told you, I think, this morning or yesterday or sometime, Second Noble Truth meditation. Keep it simple. You want something, you suffer. Third Noble Truth meditation, letting go of wanting, contentment. You're happy. That's meditation. Contentment. How can you be content when you want something else? It's amazing just how much do people want. Sometimes they don't realize what they have. What you have is beautiful, safe environment, Jhana Grove. Beautiful beds, your own en-suites. You can go there anytime you like. How many places in the world can you just go and have a nap, have a sleep, any time of the day or night? That's like heaven. You mean I don't have to work hard? I feel a bit tired, I'll just go and have a nap. 2, 3, 4, 5 times a day. Why not? If you need it, enjoy it. Catch up on your sleep. Just the fact that you can. There's no pressure on you. How many places in the world you haven't got a partner nagging you to ask you to do something? How many places in the world you don't have to achieve anything? Every time people are pushing you, come on, you can do better. You can pass your personal best in meditation. Come on, you can sit longer. What's your record? 30 minutes? Come on. A few days left, see if you can go for 40 minutes. 40 minutes, come on, yeah. Let's go for 1 hour. It's all stress. Here, no one is looking at you, taking records, pushing you. Like I said, the guitar string, the more you stretch both ends, the more tight and tense you are, the more tiny things just make you upset. When the string is really loose, just whatever happens. You're walking out there and one of the birds poops on your head. Oh, that's fertilizing my hair. Maybe it will grow more. Or whatever it is. Maybe it's just assembly, because these are birds who live in the monastery or jhana grove. So just like I was saying about the bhikkhuni's blessings, this is blessings from holy birds. No, holy water. They're from the bird. So, how many places can you just do such stuff and no one gets upset or angry at you? You can just be and enjoy. There's no pressure on you. The only pressure you have on you in this retreat is the pressure you apply to yourself. Forcing yourself, come on, you can do better than this. Come on, you can get up early. Come on, don't eat so much. Come on, do some more exercise. Oh, crikey. You don't have to do this here. It's free. What can be easier than that? Which also means that, you know, that you can actually learn meditation as the art of relaxation. Relax your body, relax the mind. Feel how you get healthy. What leads to peace and happiness? That's meditation. So, now you've got to watch your breath. Come on, watch your breath. Watch your breath. Left nostril in, right nostril out. Not too long, not too short. You know, sometimes that creates so much stress. You should know that. You should feel it. This doesn't feel right. You may not know the suttas backwards in Pali, but you know, this can't be right. When Okay, this is an important story. As a young man, I had doubts. Which is the right path? What should I do? And this is the right form of Buddhism. You know, is this the right teacher? You know, is the right place to, you know, should I be a monk? Should I be a layperson? What should I do? We always have doubts. So to overcome those doubts, I remember that when I was up in, used to go on holidays, the only place I could afford up in Scotland in the mountains with a tent, and used to sleep out there for days. You know, figured out how to make some, they had this dried Scotch broth, barley and dried peas and all sorts of stuff. So simple, but very nutritious, keeps you going. And it was like dried, so it was lightweight. And anyway, one day I was staying at a youth hostel to get a shower and get some more stuff. And then with the youth hostel warden, he's way up in the northwest coast, we decided to go for a walk up into one of the mountains. About 2 or 3 hours. They weren't really high mountains, not like Everest or something. So we went up there and we got to the top, a beautiful sunny day, no clouds anywhere, sat down, had a chat, just enjoyed the view. And I saw there was another mountain a little bit further, you know, it's still, you know, early. And so I said, let's go to the other mountain. He said, no, I'm going home, I've had enough. So I went up to the second mountain alone. And of course, that's breaking all the rules of being in the wilderness areas. You always have to have somebody with you. And it was actually, I blame the youth hostel, the local fellow. He should never allow me to do that. But it looked a beautiful day. And as I got close to the top of the other mountain, clouds came in from the sea. And I couldn't believe how fast they came in and how they descended over the mountain where I was. And I was, you know, amazing how fast. In a few minutes, it was a beautiful sunny day, another 10 or 15 minutes, I was enveloped in mist. And it was so thick, I couldn't see the end of my hand. So I realized, just go back the way you came. You go back down the mountain. So I thought I had a sense of direction. I started walking. And I was so lucky, because I was aware. One more step and it was a vertical cliff going a long way down. I stopped just in time. And later on when I got back to the hostel and looked at the ordnance survey maps, you know, there wasn't that many of those big cliffs around. The only one which I saw was 180 degrees in the opposite direction I thought I was going. And I always heard stories of people who escaped from Dartmoor prison in the mist. That's the only time they could escape. Or like people who went wandering in these moors or mountains, getting lost for days, literally going around in circles, because they didn't have any sense of direction. We think we have, but we haven't. So that's why we have GPS. If you haven't got GPS when you're driving a car, it's always GPW. You know what GPW is? Global Positioning Wife. Go this way, darling. I apologize, but that's just anecdotal experience. Nowadays you get GPM, Global Positioning Mark, tell you which way to go. But anyway, so I was in trouble. And I realized this was really scary. You know, I could fall over a cliff, you know, break my leg, and that would be it. Because, you know, it would be much better falling off a cliff, the death would be sudden. You know, falling, just breaking your leg, you'd be up there for days and probably die of hypothermia or something. You couldn't crawl out. So, big trouble, what to do? Science. My physics. I found a stream. And, you know, water always flows downhill. So I found a stream and followed it, whichever way it went. Went this way, that way. Followed it and followed it and followed it. And it meant another stream, and a little brook came in, get bigger and bigger. It was always taking me down and down and down. Because I knew if you go down far enough, you become under the mist, under the clouds. And that's what happened. I came down low enough, and the clouds, you know, they were above me, but I was underneath the cloud. Now I could get my directions and find myself eventually back to the youth hostel, safe. And I've used that as how to overcome doubt in spiritual things, especially meditation. If it's meditation, it leads to peace, to happiness, to calm, to lack of stress. Easy to see, easy to feel. And those are your standards. So, if you're meditating, you're getting more sick, something's happening there. You're not really doing the right meditation. You're getting more tense, more upset. That can't be right. But if you're meditating, you get more peaceful, more kind, more resilient. Things which bothered you before don't bother you now. More kind, less demanding. All those qualities which you know is supposed to be where this thing is leading to. If that's what's happening, great. If you go to the toilet and the shit looks more and more beautiful every day, great, that's going in the right direction. So what this means is you get an understanding how to keep it simple, how to do this stuff. And you know, sometimes the best person who tells you that you're going in the right direction is your partner. When you go back home, if your partner looks at you and say, wow, you're such a more peaceful, kind, gentle person, you've been meditating correctly. But if when you go home, your partner said, my goodness, you're worse than when you left here. You know, more angry, more upset, more wanting this, then it's obviously that it's gone in the wrong direction. That wasn't meditation. So that's a lot of times how you can find out for yourself, just very simply, whether you're going in the right direction again or not. So, that's, if you're a beginner, it's much more easy. Can you please... Okay, sorry. Given people are becoming enlightened, why is the population increasing? Given people are getting cured in hospitals, why do we need more hospitals every year? Given people are graduating from high school, why do we need more high schools? Because there's more coming in at the bottom. Not just talking about the output, but the input as well. More and more people are being born as a human being. Population is increasing. Where do they come from? Now look at the bigger picture. The bigger picture is, as the human population is increasing, the population of animals, such as monkeys, and gorillas, is actually decreasing. Can't you understand what's going on? When you think of your son and think of him as a little monkey, you know it's absolutely true. When you think of all these really rough, tough people, you know, like the Arnie Schwarzeneggers and, maybe I'll go a bit farther, but really these tough, nasty people, you know, really aggressive and stuff, who beat up and join the army, the military, and just beat up everybody. They're the gorillas. Been reborn as human beings. So, this is actually where we all come from. When all these people these days, you know that people love hugging. When I was young, you didn't hug people. All those people who started the hugging business, they were bears in their past life. What else can we say about this? But actually, the truth about it, there's actually a lot of truth there. The animal population has decreased, and many animals are actually now human beings. But don't sort of, you know, put down animals. I told you that beautiful cat, Kit Kat, how wise it was. You know, some of the dogs we have these days, they refuse to eat dog food. They want your food. I remember there's this wonderful cartoon once. You know, dogs always like human food. It's a wonderful cartoon. The family were at the dinner table having their dinner, and the dog, instead of begging, he was holding a gun up at the family. I'm done with begging.
So that's where all the populations come from.
Can you please talk about discipline? One chapter in Ajahn Chah's book is called Dharma Fighting, and it's about fighting the defilements. However, you seem to talk about melting them away with love.
Yeah. You know the again, it's the Chinese art of war. That's Sung Po as well, wasn't it? It was know your enemy, know yourself, 1,000 battles fought, 1,000 battles won. Simple. So, you fight not by kicking butt. Otherwise you get sore feet. So many butts you have to kick. You know, you had to be pretty strong feet. What you do is you understand, you use wisdom to overcome. So when it calls Dharma fighting, I don't know if it's Dharma fighting, because sometimes some of these things which they say, I never heard Ajahn Chah say that. It's just, you know, just the wrong translation. They just add something into the translation which they expect. But you don't fight defilements. You get to know them, understand them. Then you have power over them. Then you can, where they come from, what they're caused. What are the defilements? Why? You fight them and they get stronger. So they have this person, it is this Mara. How did the Buddha defeat Mara? The Buddha didn't go up to him and punch him in the nose. I know you, Mara, that's all. And the key story, which I love telling, is when somebody wanted to assassinate the Buddha. And one of their tricks, their schemes, was to give this big elephant, Nalagiri, lots of alcohol to drive the elephant mad because of, you know, drugs and drink. And they let the elephant go just when, oh, you can turn up the heat. Sometimes, have a look on there, there's two little spots and one is cooling, one is heating. In a little sun or a little icicle. Because sometimes, I think one of the last retreats, oh, the aircon isn't working. Because you've got it put on cooling, not heating. Unless you want to cool it. Shall we make it even cooler? So icicles come out of our nose? It's on there somewhere. Anyway, you get to know it. It does actually work. Just like the Dhamma works. If you know the instructions and press the right buttons. Okay. Anyway, Nalagiri, crazy, mad, powerful. And the streets in those days were really narrow. Like you go in old English places, really narrow streets. And they set the elephant running on the narrow street while the Buddha and his disciples were walking mindfully and peacefully in the opposite direction. Ringing up, taking alms from the devoted people, giving beautiful blessings. And this crazy elephant was coming the opposite direction, running fast. And people were getting injured, and they were all running, screaming, and saying, get out of the way, get out of the way, a mad elephant is coming, now, quick. Most of the people were rushing, you know, jumping over the fences and climbing up the trees and going through the houses. Quick, get out of the way. And so did many of the monks. They jumped over the fences. They climbed up the trees. They scarpered. Except for one. Ananda. The Buddha's devoted disciple. And the Buddha, he never climbed over the fences either. As the elephant was charging towards him. And Ananda, this devoted disciple, put himself in front of the Buddha. Take me, Nalagiri. I sacrificed my life for my master. That was his devotion. That was his concern and love, you know, for his teacher who had given him so much. Willing to sacrifice his life. And sometimes when I tell that story, say, Yutong, Eileen, Carol, would you actually put him for Santa and say, let them take me rather than Ajahn Chah. I wonder if it would be over that wall faster than everyone else. But anyway, what happened was, out of the way, Ananda, I can handle this.
Ananda's moment of glory was pushed aside. And so there it was, like that movie High Noon. There was a powerful, enraged, mad with drink and alcohol elephant destroying everything in its path. And the quiet, peaceful, compassionate Buddha. What would win? Peace, kindness, or mad violence? Amazing confrontation. And as they came closer, it would make a wonderful video. Because at this point, you would pause for the commercial break. This movie is sponsored by Bodhinyana Singapore in consultation with Anukampa Bhikkhuni Foundation. And then you're back to the action again. Now the Buddha. So powerful. So great psychic powers. You know, you see, I actually never seen Bruce Lee and what was the other martial arts people. They can catch the trunk really quickly. You know, just, you know, the power of just martial arts or whatever else is. Really quick, before the elephant knew. And pick him up, because incredible strength when you have psychic powers. Twirled him around the head 3 times. Gotta be 3 times. And then throw Dalagiri, no matter how heavy he was, 300 miles over the Ganges River. That would be easy for a Buddha. Simple, just... next thing you know, the elephant's on the other side of the Ganges. But that's not the ways of the Buddha. We don't fight violence with violence. Instead, the Buddha gave loving kindness. Something like Nalagiri. I forgive you already. No matter what you ever do to me, you can pick me up with your strong trunk and smash me against one of the houses. You can trample me so many times with your strong feet. You can actually gore me with your tusks, which they don't have, but that's just making that up. You can do whatever you want to me, Nalagiri, but the door of my heart will always be open to you. I'll never blame you or get angry or forgive you. I always forgive you. With that really sincere and powerful loving kindness. Not fighting with violence, but fighting violence with compassion. Powerful compassion. And then within a few seconds, Nalagiri had stopped in front of the Buddha, was bowing his head down, and the Buddha was stroking his trunk. There, Nalagiri. There, Nalagiri. That was a wonderful story, which inspired me. How you overcome anger, violence, aggression. Not with fighting, but with beautiful compassion and kindness. So if you have any craziness in your mind, if you have a defilement in your mind, you fight it, you just make it stronger. Defilement, you can do whatever you want with me. The door of my heart's always open to you. Greed, anger, delusion, it's okay. There you go. And then it all vanishes. That is how we overcome defilements. You create defilements by having anger. It's bad karma. How can bad karma lead to enlightenment? So that's actually discipline. What is the percentage of meditators you have come across that can let go soon enough in jhana? Can I have a calculator, please, and I'll look in my records? We don't work percentages. Instead of those of you who have met who can get jhanas, I've met no one who can get jhanas. Only when you're a no one can you enter jhana. That's why people sometimes put me on the spot and say, okay, Ajahn Brahm, you talk about jhanas, can you do jhanas? Can you achieve jhanas? Come on. Confess. And a lot of times, there's a rule, was it Paticca 8 for 9 or something for the monks? Say, a monk should not announce any psychic powers, any attainments, any achievements like that to lay people. But then they say, oh, come on. You know, tell us. Otherwise, we won't have any faith in you. So they asked me that so many times. So I thought, okay, I'll let you know. And I say to people, Ajahn Brahm could not enter jhana. Ajahn Brahm just can't do it. And first of all, people say, oh no, what a hypocrite. I've been following this guy, reading his instructions all these years, and now he's said in front of everybody he can't do it. And of course, I'm always a tricky monk, sneaky monk. Following my great teacher, Ajahn Chah. And I say, Ajahn Brahm can't enter jhanas. Ajahn Brahm has to vanish and disappear, first of all. And then jhanas happen. Only no one can enter jhanas. Somebody can't. The path is, but no traveler on it is seen. Even nibbana is, but no one who enters it. So that you can actually see why the Buddha put that rule down. If Carol says, I announce to everybody that Carol can enter jhanas, that's so much go, my young. Carol, you have to vanish, first of all. You disappear. Gone. No Carol.
Claire.
Okay. Well, Claire vanished, you see, and I renamed you Carol. Same. You know, just. Anyway. That's why you're Claire. Okay, so Claire vanishes. And when Claire will never get jhanas, when Claire vanishes and disappears, there's no idea of Claire anymore, then the jhanas happen. Well, that's lovely teaching, because so often I want to get jhanas. How many people get jhanas? Only no one gets jhanas. You have to be a no one. Disappear, vanish. How can I cultivate more kindness? Thank you. By not asking so many questions. Be kind to poor Ajahn Brahm. No, how to cultivate more kindness? Get a teddy bear and cuddle it for the rest of the retreat. Even when you go to the toilet, take the teddy bear in there and cuddle it. When you have your food, put the teddy bear next to it in the dining room. Remember, the teddy bear can keep noble silence, so why can't you? There we go. So teddy bears are nice. That's how you can cultivate lots of kindness. They just remind you. Just like you have a Buddha statue to remind you of wisdom, this is reminds you of kindness. Even with a bear. Oh, come on. You set me up one question after another. Even with a bear, I find it difficult to generate kindness, gentleness, compassion during meditation. Unfair. Set me up. My awareness is down. Can you advise? Get two bears. That's what the doctor says. And if you take a medication that's not working, then take a double dose. Increase the potency. A bear. And you get a bear, and let it see first of all. And number two, you can name it Ajahn Brahm. Ajahn Brahm bear. So that you can actually remember this. It's that Ajahn Brahm so kind to you. So you look at Ajahn Brahm. We can't do that. You know that sometimes that people aren't kind because we haven't been encouraged in life. People think it's juvenile to be kind. In the real world, you have to be tough. Only kind people finish last. It's wonderful. Who wants to finish first? And you've got all these cameras flashing at you. You've got to do interviews and you've got to get sponsorship. When you finish last, people leave you alone. Last is cool. Anyway, get another bear. When a thought arises during meditation, how do we care for it, yet not engage in it? and put a distance between me and the thought. Doesn't caring for it mean giving the thought importance? It doesn't mean giving it importance. It just means like you open the door of your heart to it. It's teaching you something. You're learning something from it. So you don't grab and grasp it and cherish it and plant it in a pot and water it. It comes in. You're learning something from it. Thank you for visiting me. You care for it. Because you're caring for it, in this moment, you're not attaching to it, you're caring for it. Have I cared for all of you the last few days? You know, in a couple of days' time, you're gone, and I'm gone. I'm not going to worry about you. There's other people that I'm going to care about afterwards. That is how you care. In the moment, the most important people in the world, and I'll give you my utmost. When you're gone, somebody else is going to be the most important person in the world. That's life. So, that's how you care, without getting attached and engaged. You put distance between you and the thought. In a few days' time, I'm going to put, how far is it from London to Singapore? I'm going to put a few thousand miles between me and you. But that's nice. You let it go. Okay, how do you care? This simile of a cup. I think I told this to somebody. This cup is ceramic. Ajahn Chah would get usually a glass, but ceramic works. And he'd say, that cup is cracked. And he told me to have a look at it. Can you see the crack? I said, no, I can't see any crack. I thought my teacher was cracked. Not this. And he said, you can't see the crack because it's microscopic. But it's there. If that little fissure, fracture, wasn't there, that would be like unbreakable. It's got the fracture of impermanence, fragility. Because someday, someone, probably me or anyone else, is going to be heedless and it falls on the floor and breaks. It's fragile. It's impermanent. If it was a plastic cup, you wouldn't need to worry about it. You can throw it around, kick it, play soccer with it. It would never be broken. You wouldn't need to care for it if it was unbreakable. Because every one of you are cracked. You're fragile. One day you're gone. That is why we care. If you were here all the time, you would need to care. Because you're fragile, you die, relationships have their use by date. After a while, we split. Always happens. So that's why people you care about and love, there's a crack there. Care for it. It's not there forever. Which means we care. Always knowing that one day it will disappear, fade away, go. One person said, like a relationship or life is like going in a boat, big cruise boat, from the port out into the ocean, knowing it's going to die, it's going to sink at sea. It will never return to port. It's a beautiful simile. Life is like setting off on an ocean trip, knowing it's never going to come back. You can't come back, in the sense of go back to your old homes, old moments, old relationships. We're there and it passes. We let it go. Why does the Buddha stress where does the wrong motivation or right motivation cease without remainder in the first and second jhana? Because there's not really much to say about motivations except where they come from, but the ceasing of the motivation and thoughts in that first and second jhana, the reason I put it down there is because there's not much to say, but also it makes it very, very clear that in the first and second jhana there's no thinking. Because people still say, oh, no. Ajahn Brahm, you're being too tough. Ajahn Bamali, who goes on the Buddhist Society West Australia blog, he got this response back. Oh, you're making jhana too difficult. If you say you can't think in jhana, it means that so many of us can't enjoy jhana. Can't you lower the standards so more people can come in? It was just like, you know, changing the rules for who can come into the club or into the Buddhist monastery. 227 rules is too hard. Yeah, go make it 27 rules, then more people can become monks or nuns. And that's crazy. Because jhanas are jhanas are jhanas. You can't sort of lower the entrance requirements, so just out of compassion for everyone, so more people can get jhanas. Make it easy for you. So this is stages of letting go. So that's actually, it's a nice to say that that is one place, the other places, makes it so clear. If you're thinking, if you're going in deep meditation, so, oh, this must be jhana. Can't be. If you can say that thought, then it's not jhanas. Oh, without remainder, it means that there's in that state, the motivation stops. You don't move. Because sometimes without remainder, it is... oh, that's actually what he wrote here. Without, no, I know who asked the question. Without remainder means it's stopped. There's no sort of afterglow. Because sometimes, if it's a motivation, sometimes it creates something. And what it created is still existing. So, I mean, it stopped. What it created stops. There's no effect of that motivation. No thoughts, no movement left. Okay. When I'm not meditating, there's constantly songs echoing at the back of my mind. Is it because I'm not getting used to silence? Yes. You know that even monks were not allowed to sing songs. But I was put on the spot once by, Ming, Ming Kassin, because we were doing a fundraiser. I think it was for the nuns' monastery, Dharamsala, a long time ago. And she said, Ajahn Brahm, I'll give you a check for $10,000 to the nuns' monastery if you'll sing a song. That's really rough, you know, because you're really working your butt off to try and raise money for the Dharamsala nuns' monastery. And she made this offer to break my precepts for $10,000, you know, for the sake of nuns, sacrifice, you know, do the right thing. So she put me in a spot. What should I do? But never try and outwit a smart, sneaky monk. So I said, okay, write out the check and I'll sing a song. So she wrote out the song to Dharamsala Nuns Monastery or something. $10,000, a lot of money. I said, I'm now going to sing a song. So I'm honest, I have to keep my side of the bargain. If I promise to do something, I won't sort of not do that. So I'm now going to sing one of the famous songs from my youth, a Simon and Garfunkel classic, The Sound of Silence. And I remained quiet for 3 minutes. Okay, I've done my deal. I'm banking the check. So it's okay to sing Sound of Silence when you're meditating. But it's just, something which gets into your mind, goes round and round. Because that happened once to me. I was in Bangkok, and you know, just so quiet, such a simple life. So when somebody came past, you know, I was in a Bangkok monastery with a big loud radio with some song, I was so sensitive, it stuck. I just couldn't get it out. So eventually I found out how to do it. What worked for me is when you get to the end of the song, you actually emphasize it, make it a big crescendo, just like in the great operas or great symphonies. Da, 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 da. And that actually helped stop it. And then it goes round and round. But when you actually emphasize endings, make endings really powerful, then that sometimes stops. It's really good. Anyway, that's my trick anyway. In the sutta class, it was clear what happens when an enlightened being dies. Can you explain what happens when an unenlightened being dies? What gets carried forward to the next life and what ceases without the current life? In Buddhism, we say, it's pachatang weditabo when you heed to be experienced every wise person by themselves. If I told you, would you believe me? That's being gullible. People say all sorts of things. Why do you believe me and not other people? So, if I told you, would you believe me? You say, no. No, it's not much point in me telling you. That was a Charles trick. He did that lots of times. So anyway, what gets carried forward to the next life and what ceases with the current life? It's a stream of consciousness, the cause and effect, the process. Just like the simile of, oh, mangoes, people, you know, like durians better, don't you? You eat the durian, you get one of the durians from that big store. They're still selling heaps of durians in Geylang. You know, you go past there. I know that because sometimes people, after giving a talk somewhere, when the old Buddhist fellowship was in Geylang, that they passed there and I could see people drooling. If that wasn't in the car, they'd have stopped. So they probably went there afterwards, after dropping me off. So anyway, you eat, you know, a section of durian. Really delicious. What do you do with the seed? You plant the seed in your garden. And you watch as the seed grows. It splits. And a little green shoot comes out. A little green shoot goes bigger and bigger and bigger and bigger and bigger until it goes through the soil surface. And it gets, just looks like grass at first, but that grass goes bigger and its stem becomes brown. It becomes wooden. And it grows and grows, maybe puts through a couple of small little branches, very light, very, very tender, very vulnerable, and it grows bigger and bigger until it's a sapling. And you can see from one day to another, one moment to another, the sapling grows and grows, gets bigger and bigger, shoots more and more branches, the branches have like sub-branches and twigs, and it becomes a nice little tree. And then one day you see at the end of the little twigs, instead of leaves, little flowers start to come out. It's flowering. And as it flowers, you can see the beautiful flowers and things like birds or bees or whatever it is pollinates the durian come and pollinate it. And then at the very stem of the flower, you can see it start to swell and swell and get bigger and bigger and bigger and bigger as the durian coming. Actually, the durians come from the trunk, don't they? Mangoes. I remember jackfruits, anyway, they come from the trunk. So anyway, like mangoes, whatever, it comes from somewhere. And you can actually watch it get bigger and bigger and bigger and bigger until it becomes ripe. And then you can, you know, cut it down and you eat the juicy fruit. What went from the first durian to the new durian? How did that process happen? What carried across every moment from one moment to the next? Because there's nothing in the new durian which was in the old durian. Even all the chemicals, all the molecules, the cells are totally different. They've mutated. Even the DNA slightly changes. So there is nothing there in the original durian except durian-ness, just, you know, some karma being carried across from the first durian. The first durian was really sweet. It's likely the next durian will be very sweet. If it's a bit sour, so will the next durian. Some karma carries across. But there's nothing in the first, which is in the second. That's why the Buddha said, again, not the same, not different. Because it's a process. If it was a soul, it would be the same. Something in there in the beginning, which is in there now. An essence. But if it was nothing, it would be different. It carries across information from one moment to the next, a stream of consciousness, a stream of khandhas going from moment to moment, time to time, life to life. If we shouldn't be wanting, can we don't want? You shouldn't be writing questions and don't want anything. Okay, I don't know. Anyway, we shouldn't be wanting, just don't want to write any questions. Or whatever. I usually write questions, don't want answers. If our purpose in life is to help others, if it is not, what is our purpose of life? The purpose of life is to build monasteries for good Buddhist nuns. I remember that one of my favourite cartoon strips was Calvin and Hobbes. And you know, the little boy with the tiger, Calvin and Hobbes, I love that cartoon. And someday Calvin was asking Hobbes, what's the purpose of life? And Hobbes' pet tiger said, to be tiger food. Oh, that was really cool. What is the purpose of life? Is to discover your purpose. That's a nice one. In other words, what's the purpose of life? The purpose of life is whatever you make it to be. It's not fixed. You make your purpose. Which I thought is also pretty cool. Because what is your purpose in life? You've got a choice to make it this way for your own personal pleasure. You make that your purpose. For enlightenment, for freedom, for happiness. You make the purposes of your life. You give your life purpose. Or you find out the best purpose. Oops. Arjun, occasionally his thoughts, perceptions on death would appear in the mind. How should the mind embrace or reflect on it wisely? At your age, about time. What's wrong with death? Death has got a bad rap. It needs a PR makeover. I'm afraid thinking too much or regrets it, it will become true. Nah. Yeah, sort of. What we do sometimes, I didn't do much about walking meditation, but if you get very bored and your mindfulness is all over the place, do the walking meditation in the rooms here. Your left foot walks, you say, I will die. Right foot, that's for sure. I will die, that's for sure. I will die, that's for sure. In Indonesian, it's really great. It's mati pasti. Mati pasti. It sort of rhymes. So you do that, I will die, that's for sure. Give it a go. Try it out, see what happens. Because what happens, first of all, this is stupid. This is a joke. This is one of Ajahn Brahm's funny things that, you know, makes me do. But then, after you get through just joking, you realize that's the most truest Dhamma teaching you've ever heard. You can't doubt that one. You can't find any fault in it. I will die, that's for sure. I will die, that's for sure. You get fear coming up. I will die, that's for sure. Ooh. But you carry on walking. I will die, that's for sure. And afterwards, after you get through the fear, it's wonderful. What am I worrying about? There's nothing to be concerned about. I will die, that's for sure. You don't take anything with you. So, oh, beautiful. You're free. It teaches you how to let go. To be attached. To be detached. All this stuff you think about. It's one of my sayings. Is when you get... No, not in jhana growth. It doesn't apply in jhana growth. But when you get home, don't do today what you can put off until tomorrow, because you might die tonight. I love that little saying. I'm just saying, if you haven't done the dishes yet or whatever, do the dishes first, otherwise the caretakers complain about me. You shouldn't say that simile or story while we're here. We need people to do the work. But anyway, don't do today what you can put off until tomorrow, because you might die tonight. Imagine that. You know, you get all your loose ends, all the things on the stick and all of the work done, and you find you die tonight. What a waste of a time. You didn't need to do that. I will die, that's for sure. Or don't do today what you can put off until tomorrow, because you might die tonight. One day that's going to be true. But if you're getting depressed, okay, that great little piece of wisdom by the American guru, American guru is very well known and incredibly wise, called Snoopy the dog. In Peanuts. I know Angie gets upset at me because I get it the wrong way around, but this is good enough. It's Charlie Brown and Snoopy were at some sort of pier watching the sunset when a lot of people get philosophical. And Charlie Brown looks at his dog and says, you know, Snoopy, one day we will all die. One day, we must die. And the dog, with great positive energy and much more wisdom than the human being, says, yes, but most days, we don't die. That's called positive thinking. One day you will die, but most days you don't. So enjoy while you've got the time. It's true, isn't it? Most days you don't die. So the chances of you dying, sort of on this retreat, are pretty nil. During meditation, please don't die on this retreat as well. You know, it's a real pain in the butt having to go to the Singapore embassy or consulate and getting all this stuff done. You know, that's why I tell people, you know, sometimes people actually do that. They die during the rains retreat. You know, we're supposed to be meditating. They just think about themselves. They die when they want to. They've got no concern for other people. And how much difficulty is going to be for me if you die on this retreat? So please have some respect. And wait till you get home till you die. Of course, you don't know when it's going to happen. Dear Ajahn Brahm, during meditation, I will start a commentary on the events. How do I stop letting go of the voice in my mind? If I start to speak with loving kindness to this voice, to let it go, would I have multiple personality? It's great having multiple personality. So, you know, I can be Ajahn Brahm, the funny monk. I can actually be serious sometimes. But really, not true. And I can be just Ajahn Brahm, the builder. We had some Sri Lankans come today. One of them, I think she's the wife of the speaker or something. But anyway, she loves the story I told. That one day, I was busy working, mixing concrete. You know, boys' fun. You know, I had to get in there, just mix concrete and get yourself all dirty and concretey all over the place. Really good fun. So I just finished walking back to my hut to have a shower. And this Sri Lankan girl, really high class. She came with a very expensive sari, middle age, and so many bangles, so much jewelry on her, that at first I thought it was a ice cream truck coming to the monastery. Dingle, jangle, bingle, bangle. You know what I mean. Some people wear so far too much bling, and it goes ding, bling, ding. Ding-a-ling, bling. So anyway, when she came in, you know, she saw me and said, I'm looking for Ajahn Brahm. I'm quite well known in Sri Lanka. I'm looking for Ajahn Brahm. Thinking very quickly, I said, if you go into the dining room there, you'll probably be down there in about 10 minutes. So she went up there to wait for me. And then I quickly went to my hut, showered, got in a clean set of robes. Actually, only one robe, but you know, not just the working gear, the clean robe. And went down to see her and had a nice talk with her. And she said, you know, it's a very good little Dharma talk. You know, you've got a wonderful monastery. But if you don't mind me saying, there's one complaint I have. And it just spoils your monastery. Otherwise, it's just so beautiful. You're a really good monk. But one of your monks I met on the way here, and he was very badly dressed with lots of dirty marks on him. You know, this is a Buddhist monastery. You shouldn't allow monks to do that. I said, oh really? Oh, I'll talk to him later, ma'am. It was me. She didn't know the difference. So she didn't realize it was the same monk. And I don't lie. I do talk to myself. Good night, Ajahn Brahm. Good morning, Ajahn Brahm. So, that's multiple personality. That's why I was going with that. So I've got multiple personality. You play around, be whatever you want. Isn't that good? I did this gig at the World Computer Conference. That was in Daejeon in Korea, 2015. What am I doing there? Okay, so I was a computer expert. I can play around anything and make it up as you go along. It's good fun. So multiple personalities mean you've got no personality. There's no sense of self. So that means you can be whatever you want, anytime, change around. There's no core being there, which is thick. I'm a monk. You can do whatever you want. Isn't that nice? Anyway, where are we going with this one? Well, you stop and let go of the voice in my mind because you've got a commentary. Okay, next thing to do, exercise, when you go home or you go on Singapore Airlines or whatever airlines and there's a screen on the back, look at the movie with no commentary. Or even better, a football match or a tennis match, Singapore versus Malaysia. Now, listen to it with the Singapore TV station and see the commentary there. Compare it to the same match being commented by Malaysia. Oh, that was so unlucky! That's, you know, if Singapore sort of try and score a goal, but it just hit the post. Malaysia said, oh, that was a stupid shot. Or, even better than that, there was a story in Cottesloe Beach, which is very, very, you know, popular beach in Perth, famous, and there was a shark sighting. So there was a shark, and so they rang the siren or the bell, and most people actually just swam quickly to shore, but there were three young children still swimming. And this young, strong, blonde-haired young man dived into the water, swam, just so strong and fast, and managed to get two of the children and carry them to the beach, but there's still one out there being circled by the shark. And he went in again, you know, punched the shark, really, really brave, grabbed the child and brought him to the beach, a real hero. But that wasn't all. He went out there again with a knife because that shark might sort of kill somebody else. And he battled with that shark and killed the shark and came back to the beach. A real hero. And there was a journalist there. And the journalist said, I've never seen anything so brave. You're a true Aussie hero. I'm going to write about you. I'm a journalist in the front page of the news tomorrow. I can see the headline. Aussie hero risks life to save children. And then the young man actually said, well, actually, I'm British. I'm on holiday here. And so the next day, the headlines were, Pommy Bastard Kills Endangered Species. That's commentary for you. It's always biased. So your commentary is the same. It's not true. It's not accurate. It's always had spin, what you want, what you like. Okay. So turn off the commentary and you realize how the commentary is not the truth. Please explain more about when meditating, place your awareness, whatever object in front of you. I don't have to be the breath. Is it the darkness in front of you as the eyes close? If you're watching the eyes, first of all, it is the darkness and it disappears. And when that disappears, something else will come up. You're always aware of something. So what are you aware of right now? Whatever that is, it's important. So you don't choose, because choosing is controlling or wanting. Just whatever is aware you're aware of right now, just be with it. Such a simple thing to do. And it actually, it makes a huge progress in meditation. You go very deep, very quick. What is a Buddhist practice to get rid of home infestations by cockroaches and ants? Remember what I told you this morning? Did I tell you that cockroach story? Okay. Well, just, why are you killing the cockroaches? You're jealous of them because they they scare your wife and you don't. How do you get rid of cockroach infestations and ants? The cockroaches or ants are in there because they can get some sort of food or something there. So make your house more clean. Put some more screens up there or stuff so there's, you know, keep it sort of spotlessly clean. So a cockroach might go in there or an ant might find it there, and it goes back to the big ants and say, nothing there, folks. You know, nothing for us to eat. So that means they won't come again. They're only there because there's something for them. So that's the best way, just to make sure it's really clean and there's no little holes anywhere they can get in. Ajahn Brahm, given that we've got irregular paydays and paychecks, how can we self-check that we are building a solid foundation instead of a wobbly one as far as mindfulness is concerned? What are the warning signs? I think that simile I gave you of like doubt, you know, by you're lost in the mist. So find some sort of sign, like are you getting more peaceful? Are you sleeping better at night? Are you happier when people actually tell you things you don't like to hear? Are you just more, oh, it doesn't matter? And are you wiser? Are you kinder? And if you can't tell, the people who live with you can. The old story, I think I said already, about many women have come on to a meditation time. Oh, it's a better story. Early on, when Ajahn Chakra was here with me, that there was one guy who always wanted to go on a meditation retreat. On a weekend, that's all. And his wife, he asked his wife, can I go on a meditation retreat this weekend? She said, of course not. There's too many things to do. You've got to clean the gutters, help with the shopping, take the kids to sport. Too busy. So he said, okay. And so next time a meditation retreat for the weekend, can I go for a retreat this weekend? He said, no, mother-in-law's coming. You know, we've got to sort of clean out the shed. We've got to fix up the window, whatever it was. No, we're too busy. But he kept on being persistent. He never argued, just persistence. Until one day he said, there's a meditation retreat this weekend, can I go? And she was so fed up with him, she said, okay, you go and do your meditation retreat. You leave me with the kids and the shopping and the cleaning. And he took that as a yes. So off he went to the meditation retreat. And when he came home, he told us this story, he was such an improved husband. She noticed that he was so more peaceful and kind and loving and compliant. She was impressed so much, he told us, because he came on the very next weekend retreat. I said, oh, you got permission to go? I didn't even need to ask permission, he said. My wife gave me the money and sent me off. Because it actually works. If it really is working, the sign is that the next time you want to go on a retreat, your husband says, oh, here's the money, please go. He sees the benefit. It's just like sending your car in for a service. If you want a new, improved wife, send her to the monastery for a few weeks. And she comes back bright and bushy-paled and so much kindness and compassion. It's true. That's why... Oops, come on. It's not time to go to bed yet. That's why... There's a bit of a joke, this, but many people in Perth, girls, single girls, whenever they hear a monk is disrobed, they get very excited. Because it's well known now, all the monks I've trained here, when they disrobe, they become amazing husbands. The women tell me this, people who marry them. They say, thank you, Ajahn Brahm, for training my husband before I actually married him. This is anecdotal, but you ask people who've married a monk and say, oh, they're beautiful husbands, they're great. Greatest catch, they've been trained by Ajahn Brahm, quality control. You can't get better than that. Top of the range. But why? It's because you train them in kindness and softness and meditating, listening to themselves, for teddy bear, getting their sort of their kindness, their compassion going, their sensitivity, their trust, their honesty, reliability, all that sort of stuff which you get trained in, keeping your precepts. It works. Unfortunately, there's no monks who are disrobing soon. And those who already did are already bagged. Dear Ajahn Brahm, you have taught us some valuable teachings these few days. However, why do you have that word, however? You should have stopped there. However, some buts. However, as the retreat comes, it hasn't come to an end yet. It comes to an end. Stop rushing forward. You've got many days yet. And we'll have to return to our lives and face the reality of the harsh world. Honestly, people say, Ajahn Brahm, when we go back to the real world. Now, think of, contemplate it. Where you go, is that the real world? Where people have to dye their hair wear deodorants, Botox, breast implants, high heels. You go in the shops and they're all fake colours. You know, you don't even talk to one another. You use your iPods to text one another, whatever it is, to text one another. It's not real conversations. You find all your information fake news. What is the real world? Even like, what was it in the, Singapore, when all the young men have to do national service? I remember reading the Straits Times. The people who organized that were just amazed. They say, first time when we take people, national service, out sort of camping. Not really camping, but, the tents and exercises. The young recruits say, where's the aircon? They're not used to actually just being in nature. So who really lives in the real world? So here is the real world. No TVs. Please, don't have to use your iPhones and iPads and whatevers. Use these eyes. And then you find, actually, this is much more real. It's actually much more peaceful. So anyway, we turn to our lives and face the fake reality of the harsh world. Deadlines, bills to be paid, no responsibilities to our parents, family. So how can we continue to abide by these teachings when we step out of jhana grove in a few days' time to remain peaceful, to let go? Stop thinking about it. It hasn't happened yet. Why are you wasting these precious opportunities to be peaceful? You're already ahead. You're already at home, and you've still got a few days left to go. Don't send your mind too far out in the future. Enjoy these precious moments while they're here. Enjoy every moment you've got. And only maybe just half an hour before you have to leave. Only then pack your bags. What day is it today? It's Wednesday. You're not leaving till Saturday or Sunday, some of you. So you're not even halfway through yet and you're already finished. So please, don't be too far ahead. You're enjoying this moment. Make sure every moment counts. This moment is the only moment you have. Please cherish it. And when you go back, then you know how to cherish the moments when you're back at work. Dear Ajahn, how can we reconcile leading an extremely, exceptionally busy life with serious practice of the Dhamma, with a view to ending all willing activity? Venerable Chanda, am I an exceptionally busy monk? Are you an exceptionally busy nun? Yeah, well, come on. Yeah, but I'm an exceptionally busy monk. How do I manage to live an exceptionally busy life, but still be peaceful and happy? Time to be busy, you're just busy. If there's something to do, you do it. If there's nothing to do, you do nothing. Please. So simple. Ajahn Chah's teaching. He was, this Sydney man told me this. He heard that Ajahn Chah was a very famous wise monk. So, when Ajahn Chah was still able to teach, I must have been there at the time, because as soon as I left, Ajahn Chah sort of stopped teaching. And about a week after, 2 weeks after, he had his stroke. But this Sydney man apparently went to see Ajahn Chah to ask really deep questions. Just to go to that monastery, turn around and come back. Very busy guy. And when he got to Ajahn Chah's hut, he was surrounded by so many people, he didn't have a chance to ask his questions. So he waited there an hour, 2 hours. All these people, all they were doing was taking photographs. Actually, that's not what he's doing, but sometimes that's what happens to me. Anyone who has any serious questions has to wait until all the photographs are taken and all that stuff. Anyway, that's important to people. So when they'd finished, Ajahn Chah, Sydney guy, thought, no chance to ever ask my questions. All that way for nothing. So he got up and went to the front of the monastery to get his taxi. But he realized he had another half an hour to kill. So what he did was, he saw some monks sweeping, so he decided to do some good karma, to sweep. It's not his job, it's not your job to clean up, but if you see the opportunity, you do it. So he started sweeping, and after a few minutes of sweeping, he felt someone's hand on his shoulder. He turned around and found that hand belonged to Ajahn Chah. Ajahn Chah had seen this young man, and Ajahn Chah had to go somewhere else. So on his way, he stopped by this Australian man from Sydney, couldn't ask his questions, and Ajahn Chah just gave him some advice. And that man from Sydney said, "That was the best advice I ever got. That's all I needed." And the advice was, "If you're going to sweep, give it everything you've got." That's what he said. But this was from a great monk. It wasn't about sweeping. He understood it straight away. If you are meditating, give meditation everything you've got. Don't go thinking about, you know, what you're going to do when you leave or when you get to London or when you get to Singapore. Meditation time. Give meditation time everything you've got. Just this, nothing else. When it's eating, give eating everything you've got. You're pretty good at that. And when you're sleeping, give sleeping everything you've got. So when you go to bed at night, you don't think what you're going to have to do in the morning. You don't think about what Ajahn Brahm said, you know, tonight. It's sleep time. Give sleep everything you've got. Nothing else. Don't think about business, anything. Don't think about nibbana. It's sleep time. And when you are working, give work everything you've got. When you're with your family, family everything you've got. When you're teaching others, you give teaching everything you've got. And when I've finished teaching, go into my room, I just give being room everything I've got. And that was such a beautiful teaching. And this fellow said his business flourished. Really successful businessman. His family life, when he was with his kid, he gave his kid everything he got. When he's with his wife, you're the most important person in the world, he gives that total attention, everything you've got. Sleep, really slept well. Meditation, that was meditation time. Everything I've got for meditation. Really successful, great family, and a good meditator. What do we do though? Yeah, we're meditating, but we're thinking of just what am I going to do when I get back to the reality of my harsh life. You're not giving everything you've got. And when you're with your working for the company or whatever, you think, oh, just what about that party I'm going to have to go to this evening? Or what am I going to tell my kids? Or what? You're not really there. And when you're sleeping, you think of all sorts of problems. So that means you're not giving this moment everything you've got. Such a simple teaching. So successful. That's if I'm an abbot, you have to do some administration, I give it everything I've got. And then, afterwards, I'm in my cave, and I lock the door, and I give silence, peace, everything I've got. You've all got caves, call your little rooms, places for you. When you're on the aircraft, you're traveling, give that everything you've got, you're traveling. That is giving this moment everything you've got. Great teaching of Ajahn Chah. When you sweep, oh, I've seen some of the monks still don't get that. They sweep a little bit and they start talking about dependent origination. If you're going to contemplate the Dharma, give that everything you've got, but not when you're sweeping. So that's actually how you do it. That's exceptionally busy life with serious practice of the Dharma. With a view, and that's giving everything you've got when you meditate, everything you've got, and you soon get so still and peaceful. And then when you retire, give retirement everything you've got. And when you're dying, give death everything you've got. Let go. Oh, one last thing. And whenever you pass a donation box in the monastery, give it everything you've got. It never works. I got all these scams. People actually follow the Dharma up to a point, but then greed takes over. Okay, never mind. Anyway, sadhu. Everything you've got, sadhu. Everything you've got, sadhu. See, it works. Okay. Have a good sleep, and when you go to sleep tonight, remember to give everything you've got.